From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The biggest sports event on Earth is coming to America this month, soccer's World Cup. On today's Fresh Air, a guide to the World Cup for Americans who may not know much about it. We talked to British sports writer Pete Davis, author of 22 Foreigners in Funny Shorts. Also, NPR commentator, house cleaner, and former Santa's elf David Sedaris returns. He'll read from his first book, a new collection of stories and essays called Barrel Fever. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of historic Benjamin Britten recordings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States is ready to seek United Nations economic sanctions against North Korea. American officials say international weapons inspectors report they can't confirm the status of North Korea's nuclear program anymore. A State Department spokesman says the statement is in a letter to UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. The inspectors say they aren't sure how much plutonium North Korea has produced in its experimental reactor. The letter is the trigger for Washington to seek sanctions, but the State Department acknowledges it will take some time to get the Security Council to go along. Council member China has long been resistant to the idea. President Clinton has met with Italy's new prime minister, Silvio Berlusconi. This is the start of Mr. Clinton's week-long trip to Europe to commemorate the 50th anniversary of D-Day. The president held a joint news conference with Berlusconi and spoke glowingly of Italy's help in some of the world's trouble spots.
I was able to tell the prime minister personally how much I appreciated the support that Italy has given for NATO's efforts to resolve the conflict in Bosnia, and for the support Italy has given, particularly to the United States Armed Forces and all the efforts we undertake in this part of the world.
The president began his meetings in Rome today by visiting Pope John Paul at the Vatican. The pope used the opportunity to speak out strongly against abortion. Lebanese guerrillas fired rockets into northern Israel today. It was in retaliation for an Israeli airstrike earlier today on a guerrilla base in Lebanon's Bekaa Valley. The base is controlled by the pro-Iranian Hezbollah organization. Lebanese officials say between 26 and 45 people were killed and dozens injured. NPR's Paul Miller reports.
Israel's airstrike on a training base a few miles from the Lebanese border with Syria was one of its most devastating. Lebanese sources say planes rocketed the base while the militiamen were sleeping, then strafed the camp with machine guns. Israeli officials said they had good intelligence about the location of the base and acted on it. They described the raid as part of their ongoing battle with the pro-Iranian Hezbollah militia and said if Lebanon could not control Hezbollah, Israel would. In retaliation, the Lebanese militia fired rockets into northern Israel. There were no reports of damage or injuries. Israel Radio described the situation on both sides of the border as tense. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
Lebanese sources say the training base was for youngsters between the ages of 12 and 18. Lebanon has asked the UN Security Council to investigate the incident. PLO officials say Chairman Yasser Arafat is seriously ill. There's no indication of what could be wrong. PLO says Arafat's doctors have planned to move him to a Jordanian hospital. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 3 points at 37.57. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. A Texas jury has convicted an executive of an American Express subsidiary of laundering drug money. Antonio Giraldi was convicted of conspiracy, money laundering, and fraud. Prosecutors in Brownsville say the $30 million involved came from one of Mexico's most notorious drug empires. Giraldi's former assistant was also convicted on several charges. Prosecutors say the pair knew they were handling tainted money. The defense says the bankers made routine legal transactions for a man who fooled them into believing, or rather getting them to believe, that he was legitimate. The Navy is facing a multimillion-dollar discrimination lawsuit. The case involves black workers at a Florida Navy base. John Thielen reports from Pensacola.
10 years after a successful discrimination lawsuit against Eglin Air Force Base, 32 black employees at Pensacola's Naval Air Station have filed a similar action seeking $130 million. The group known as Cohesion Incorporated alleges discrimination in promotion, training, and treatment of those with health conditions, underrepresentation in management, more severe punishment than white workers for similar violations, and a requirement that blacks document education or experience on job applications. The suit charges administrative and union grievance procedures have not worked, and the base human resources office has actually promoted job discrimination. The earlier suit against the Air Force brought a multi-million dollar judgment and court-supervised hiring and promotion. For National Public Radio, this is John Thielen in Pensacola.
A published report says smugglers aren't letting the government or police officers stop them from bringing illegal Chinese immigrants to the United States. The Washington Post reports groups that smuggle Chinese nationals are expanding a worldwide network. The paper says the smugglers can move tens of thousands of illegal immigrants into the U.S. The paper quotes unidentified U.S. officials who say the development has prompted authorities to rethink their manner of trying to stop smuggling. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The World Cup, the biggest athletic event in the world, is coming to America this month, and some Americans couldn't care less. Soccer has never caught on as a spectator sport in America, but a lot of American and international soccer fans are hoping that's about to change. Although many Americans know nothing about the sport, young people are growing up with it. Did you know that more children under 12 play soccer than any other organized sport except baseball? And in American colleges, there are more men's soccer teams than football teams. My guest's enthusiasm for soccer is contagious. Peter Davis wrote a book about the 1990 World Cup in Italy. His new book is a guide for Americans to the 94 World Cup. It's called 22 Foreigners in Funny Shorts. The World Cup begins June 17th in Chicago. 52 games will be played over the following 4 weeks in 9 different cities. I asked Davis why the U.S. was chosen as the site for the 94 World Cup.
Money. Plain and simple, money. FIFA, the Federation of International Football Associations, which is the world body in charge of the world game, views the USA as the last and largest uncracked market for its sport. And it wants to get into that market, and it wants a professional game up and running in the USA. One element of that is that the only area in which the World Cup cannot compete with the Olympics. The World Cup is bigger than the Olympics. It lasts for 4 weeks instead of two. It's only one game, whereas the Olympics is however many handfuls of games. But the one thing that the World Cup can't compare with the Olympics is the revenue the Olympics generates from American network television. And while the whole of the rest of the world watches soccer, to the extent that pretty much half the population of the planet will watch the final of the World Cup in LA on July 17th, the American networks don't chip in, and FIFA want your money. And it's as simple as that. They want you to get excited about the game.
I think, you know, a lot of Americans have never paid much attention to broadcasts of soccer and aren't really very familiar with the sport, especially people who are older and didn't grow up playing it in school. You're an enormous soccer fan. What do you love about it? What is beautiful and special and different about soccer?
The principal attraction of soccer is A, that it's simple, incredibly simple. B, that it's fluid. The whole essence of the game is to have the minimum possible interruption so that the action in a good game moves from end to end all the time. The referee's job is to keep it flowing, not to be interrupting it. There's no plays in the sense, the American sense of that word. The game belongs to the players. The coach can really do very little other than chew his nails on the sideline and scream.
Because the action is uninterrupted.
The action is uninterrupted. So on television, what Americans are going to see, which is terrifically exciting, is two periods of 45 minutes of a sport that does not stop without commercial interruption, which I'm sure will be a delight to many Americans who are accustomed to having whatever they're watching interrupted by commercials all the time. But beyond the fluidity and the simplicity of it, those characteristics also make it an extremely expressive game. There are a lot of people who talk about soccer as art, not perhaps in Great Britain, where we're rather workmanlike in the way that we play the game, but if you talk to the French or the Brazilians or the Italians, soccer is an art. It's the theatre of dreams. It's for the working class urban environment from which it originally sprang a century ago. It was a form of expression for people who had no other form of expression. And people watch soccer now as then because they're looking to see people do deft, graceful, rapid, brave things with a ball that is round and you can't use your hands, so it's incredibly difficult. Everybody knows that it's as fiendishly difficult as it's beautifully simple.
What are some of the fiendishly difficult things or dangerous things that happen in soccer?
Well, I mean, one American convert to the game recently said to me that in American football, the quarterback throws the ball for 40 yards and the wide receiver is out there going the 100 yards in 10 seconds and catching the ball with two defenders on his shoulders, breathing down his neck, all happening in the blink of an eye. And in soccer, they do that too, but they don't use their hands. You are attempting to control a difficult object while large men all around you are coming in on you, attempting to prevent you having that control. You have to beat people to sway and to swerve and to feint and to shimmy, but not using your hands. And that's the start of it. When you get good moves, when you get the Brazilian one-touch paradigm where each of them passes the ball on to the next with only one touch and everybody has vision and awareness and you see the ball flowing up the field from one man to another, and as I say, each of them has only used one touch, one little stroke, the back heel, the instep, the knee, the head, the chest, the shoulder, the ball is being zipped up the field. And when it reaches that Brazilian peak, the other team might as well be chasing shadows. It's so graceful.
Yet even you admit that there are often long, boring stretches in soccer games.
Yeah, because it's difficult. And also because not everybody plays like Brazil. It's a difficult game to play well. Mm-hmm. And you can't have 11 guys hit that magic thing called form in every game, every day. And then, you know, other teams, you know, not everybody plays attractive football. You know, Norway, boy, those guys are boring.
You know, I think something that's going to be difficult for Americans who are unfamiliar with soccer to comprehend is how so many games can end up in a draw. I mean, in American sports, if you have to go into extra innings in baseball, you go into extra innings and you just play till somebody wins.
Yes, I realize that it's completely incomprehensible to the American psyche how a game can end without a result. And what you would make of cricket, where you can play for 5 days and have a draw, Lord only knows. The point is that to us, a draw is a result. In league games, where you are playing, say you're in a league of 22 clubs and you are playing each of the other 21 at home and away over those 9 months, if you come to the end of 90 minutes and you have a draw, then each team is awarded a point and that is considered to be a result. In the World Cup, once you get to the second round, a draw won't settle it and you do have to have a result. But in the first round, where teams are jockeying for position in a round robin, if you can't separate those two teams over 90 minutes, then it is equitable and just to reward them with a point apiece, in my opinion. And That's the way we think about it.
Soccer is, of course, a big international sport, and the World Cup is the international championship. Are there different styles in different countries that we should be looking for?
Absolutely. I suspect that the final will be won 3-1 by Brazil in 90 minutes over Germany. That's my tip. And I'll probably be wildly wrong and it'll end up being in Italy and Colombia. But Brazil and Germany, on paper, are the strongest two teams that are coming. And you could not ask for more diametrically opposite styles. Brazilian soccer is a carnival. It is absolutely wonderful to watch. They have won the World Cup 3 times. The last time was in 1970 with the greatest team of all time. And they play it for joy. It really is a dream to watch a fine Brazilian team stroke. They stroke the ball about amongst themselves like a baby being passed amongst adoring relatives. It's a joyous thing to watch. The Germans are a complete contrast, whereas Brazil's attitude will be, oh, well, never mind defence, because however many you score, we'll score more. The Germans are massively more organised. They have all those Teutonic virtues of strength, discipline, speed. They play soccer the way that they make cars. It's an engineering masterpiece, a good German team. Fast, solid, reliable, diligent, exceptionally well organised, and a sinister Matt Gleam on the bodywork. There is such a contrast there. If you then look at other teams, the Italians are also artists. They are very pleasant to watch. They don't have the recklessness that the Brazilians can sometimes have. They have more panache. The Italians, you know, it's Armani suit time when you watch them play. It's very nicely cut.
You covered the World Cup in 1990 in Italy, and I know you've been to soccer tournaments probably around the world. What's it like in the stands? I know in England there's a lot of chants and songs during a game. Does this happen around the world?
Yes, everywhere that soccer is played, the crowd is part of the game. You do not go to a soccer game to watch it. You go to take part. One of the things that's probably culturally difficult for Americans to understand is the way in which we're happy to lose our individuality in a soccer crowd. You become one cell in the body of the beast when you join a soccer crowd.
Well, there's a lot of that in American sports too. The big mm-hmm. wave and
yeah, there's more to it than the waving, because it's. I mean, a lot of American sports now cost such a fortune and to mm-hmm. go to and have been so grotesquely over-commercialized that it's really a sort of a middle-class activity to be sitting there, and everybody's terrifically polite. And I've been to soccer games in the USA with big crowds, and it's been so polite.
Let me bring up a subject that I think a lot of Americans are worried about and several cities are bracing themselves for, and that is soccer riots. There have been some really disturbing riots that have broken out around soccer games in the past. When the World Cup was held in Italy, the country spent $65 million on security. There were 50,000 officers and staff members. 384 fans were deported for unruly behavior. In 1985, at a European Cup final in Belgium, there were fights between Italian and British fans that ended in 39 deaths. In 1989, at an Association Cup semifinal in England, 95 fans were killed in a crush. Do you think there's going to be violence at the World Cup in America?
I don't think there'll be that much violence. The whole business is massively over-sensationalised. You have to remember that this is a huge sport, passionately followed by millions. If you just consider the World Cup itself, 52 games, if you held 52 rock concerts of comparable stature with comparable crowds, would there be no incidents of disorder at all? Now, soccer is followed more passionately than most rock music is. All around Europe, all the time, for 9 months of the season, there are huge numbers of people going through the turnstiles at enormous numbers of games. And there are always going to be incidents when that many millions of people are involved. Just to put it in perspective, for every 10,000 people that go through the turnstiles of the English game, 3 are arrested. You're dealing with an event of such magnitude that it is impossible to conceive that there could not be some sort of disturbance somewhere. But it's very, very important to understand that the genuine hooligans, the hardcore of psychotic numbskulls who use soccer as a locus to express all their foul racism and just general bigotry and desire to punch people and break heads and break windows, that's a tiny, tiny minority of the people who love the game and go to watch it.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been in the middle of a soccer riot?
I've been to so many soccer games that, I've seen trouble going on. I mean, there is trouble here and there. Usually it's not a big deal. Usually it's 20 idiots throwing beer glasses. The major events haven't happened not to have been at, but the two that you refer to were both tragedies. And the 95 people who were crushed to death at Hillsborough, that was a tragedy due to incredibly maladroit handling of a large crowd in a small space by the authorities. The 39 fans who died at the Heysel Stadium in Belgium, that was to do with fighting, but again, incredibly maladroit handling of the situation by the authorities, who had not segregated the fans.
Segregated the fans?
Yes, you have fans from two opposing clubs. It's standard procedure to have fans from different clubs sitting in different parts of the ground, and then failed to do that. Now, the World Cup, virtually impossible to do that, but then at the World Cup, there's not going to be that many countries present who bring dangerous people, I think.
Which are the countries that you think bring dangerous people?
Well, the English have the reputation for it, and they're not going. So you'll save that problem.
Because they're not in the championship.
But, No, they have failed to qualify. But while the English have the reputation for it, it is actually a European-wide problem, and one that I would like to say has been very largely brought under control in England. But there are outbreaks of trouble around Italian games, around German games. I think if anybody's like... The Dutch have a pretty ferocious reputation for their nasty little minority as well, but the Dutch travelling fans have always been wonderful. The Germans have a nasty element, who may come. As far as security is concerned, I'm actually more concerned for innocent visitors to the USA who don't know their way around and will end up taking the wrong exit ramp, driving into the wrong part of town and getting shot, than I am for outbreaks of trouble around World Cup games.
Pete Davis is my guest. He's the author of the book 22 Foreigners in Funny Shorts, The Intelligent Fan's Guide to Soccer and World Cup 94. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Pete Davis. He writes about soccer, and his new book is a guide to the World Cup called 22 Foreigners in Funny Shorts. The Federation of International Football Associations was hoping that the United States would start a new professional soccer league in exchange for the World Cup being held here, right?
Well, when the organizers, when the United States Soccer Federation made its bid to win this tournament, which was back in, I think, 88... One of the elements of the deal was that a professional league would be got up and running. It hasn't happened. They are now saying that it will happen in 95. I'm very, very positive and optimistic that the World Cup will be an enormous success. I'm very much less so about the prospects for a league. I would be very pleased if it happened because I love the game, and I have many American friends, I've been to the States a lot, who are always expressing an interest in it, and if it does come about, terrific, but it'll have to be operating at a very sensibly modest level. It'll have to be regionalized. You can't be getting on planes the way the basketball players can. You can't be going across that huge continent on planes. You're going to have a very modest player cap as far as salaries are concerned. You're going to have to look to play in small stadia with crowds of 15,000 or so.
Would you just explain the structure of the World Cup, you know, how the different rounds play out? Just give us an overview of what's going to be happening for the month that the World Cup is in progress.
There are 24 finalists. The hosts, the USA, the champions, Germany, qualify as of right. 22 others have qualified out of some 500 games that have been going on around the world over the last 2 years. The 24 finalists are then divided into six groups of four, which each play a round robin. Everybody plays everybody else. You get 3 points for a win, one for a tie, diddly squat for losing. At the end of those first 2 weeks in which the round robins have been played, the two sides in each of the six groups that are in first and second place go through, plus the four best third-placed teams, which is a little bit complicated and unfortunate, but that's the way it is. You come through with 16 out of the original 24. Eight go home. In the second round, the 16 that remain then play a knockout competition, a straight knockout, a round of 16, quarterfinals, semifinals, final. It's a matter of having three games for every team in the opening round to find form. It's so that somebody doesn't turn up, play a nightmare of a game and go straight home again. Everybody has the chance to find their feet, to find their form, to get into shape, to get into the second round, and after that all bets are off and it becomes just terrifically exciting.
So what is the television coverage going to be like in the United States, do you know?
I expect it to be rather good. 11 games live on ABC at the weekends, with the remaining 41 games on ESPN, and I believe that ESPN are getting behind it. I've seen ABC do a game last summer when your American side played the Germans for the first time and achieved a very creditable 4-3 loss. Very few people score three goals against the Germans. And the ABC coverage was not bad, not bad at all. Had a habit of following the ball too much, because you need to look, when you're watching a game, you need to look back and have the big picture in your mind, because you have to look at all the guys that are making all the runs that aren't on the ball. And there were times when I thought the camera was staying with the ball too often and not looking at the rest of the play. But overall, the coverage was good. There was more talk than we tend to have, but it was intelligent, it was informed talk, it was useful talk, it was quite educational. I thought they were being very helpful to the audience, and overall I was quite optimistic about it. I think it looked promising.
I'm not sure a Welshman is the right person to ask this question to, but I'll ask it anyways. Why do you think soccer has not caught on in America the way it has in other countries?
Well, it's the great American exceptionalism, isn't it? It's like, why has socialism never caught on in America? Soccer, when people emigrated to the USA in the great period of emigration from the 1880s, the 1890s, that was the time when soccer was taking off with extraordinary rapidity in Europe and Latin America. But as people emigrated, they learnt to speak English in order to become Americans, and they learnt to play baseball. The whole point about going to the USA was that you reinvented yourself. You became an American. You became something new and different and more exciting, with more potential and possibility than you felt that you had had in the country of your origin. So soccer was something that people sloughed off, really, in order to learn the distinctive American games. And it never really had a chance, because of people wanting to define something new and American about themselves.
You said the Federation of International Football Associations, the regulating mm-hmm. body for soccer, really wants soccer to catch on in the United States now, in part so it can make some more money and reach yep. a bigger audience. But do you think that the United States is going to try to change soccer a little bit to adapt it more to either an American style or American style of television broadcasting, such as having more opportunities for commercial breaks on TV?
Well, that would be resisted. It's the world game, and the rest of the world would resist that. If you start playing it in four periods instead of two, for instance, the rest of the world won't have that. Simply won't have that. We won't allow that. The game is designed to be played in two periods. And if your television can't cope with it, then that makes it difficult for the game to succeed in the USA, because it won't be shown on television, because we will not have the game being played in four quarters. The whole point of it is flow. Now, if...
You sound very adamant about this.
Yes.
All right.
Absolutely and passionately believe that if attempts are made to meddle with what is, I'm afraid, our game, just so that Americans can make more money, then the rest of the world will be furious. Absolutely furious. The game is great because of the way it is. To go and start messing it about so it can go on American television. No, I'm afraid the Americans who play soccer don't want that to happen, and we don't want it to happen either.
Pete Davis, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
That's my pleasure.
Pete Davis is the author of a guide to the World Cup called 22 Foreigners in Funny Shorts. He lives in North Wales and spoke with us from the NPR Bureau in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. David Sedaris is a house cleaner by day, a writer at night, and most famous as a former elf in Santaland. Sedaris is a commentator on NPR's Morning Edition. Coming up, he reads from his new collection of stories and essays, Barrel Fever. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD set of historic recordings by composer Benjamin Britten. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton and Pope John Paul met this morning at the Vatican. Both sides are disagreeing over what happened in their meeting. The president says he and the pontiff discussed abortion and that he made some progress with the pope toward finding common ground. He says both of them agreed that abortion shouldn't be used as a means of birth control. But the Vatican disagrees. A spokesman says the only way to close the gap on this matter is for Mr. Clinton to move toward the church's position, firm opposition to abortion. A federal judge in Texas says the Brady gun control law is constitutional despite challenges by the National Rifle Association and county sheriffs. The decision is the second in a series of lawsuits claiming the Brady law violates states' rights. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The Texas judge's decision directly contradicts a ruling 2 weeks ago in Montana, which found that the Brady gun control law forced states to do the federal government's bidding. The law requires local police and sheriffs to conduct background checks on all handgun buyers, and it puts handgun purchases on hold 5 days while the checks are conducted. The Montana judge declared the background check a violation of the 10th Amendment, which guarantees states' rights. The Texas judge disagreed, saying the checks do not commandeer state legislatures and only place minimal duties on police. Both suits were brought by county sheriffs with the assistance of the National Rifle Association. 4 similar lawsuits are pending in federal courts in Vermont, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Arizona. This is Howard Berkus reporting.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich is pointing to a new report on labor and management. The report says the proportion of low-wage workers in the U.S. is rising, and that's creating an underclass, even as higher-level workers are doing better. Reich says this means the nation is dangerously divided along wage and educational lines. 3,500 United Auto Workers are on strike against General Motors in Detroit, Michigan. UPI's Mark Mead has this report.
The sprawling one-mile-square campus is GM's main research and engineering facility. The United Auto Workers Union says management broke off a marathon bargaining session without any agreement on local issues. The union's key concern is job security, what they call technology transfer. Union Vice President Earl Hartman says that's leaving his membership with outdated skills and expendable jobs.
If we want to be part of the future of the General Motors Corporation, then it was mandatory that we draw the line in the sand on the transfer of new technology.
Talks between the UAW and General Motors resume Friday morning. Mark Mead, Detroit.
The government says the index of leading economic indicators was unchanged in April. The Commerce Department says the index stayed at 101.2. Analysts say this indicates a cooling economy. On Wall Street, the Dow lost 2 points today to close at 3,758. This is NPR. The United Nations is putting off a new attempt at a ceasefire in Bosnia. The UN says Bosnian Serbs have broken their promise to pull out their forces from around the Bosnian Muslim town of Garajda. They're supposed to withdraw their troops 1.8 miles away from the city. The UN Special Envoy for Bosnia says negotiations won't start until the Serbs comply. He says he was told by Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic that the withdrawal would come yesterday, but the UN patrols there say it hasn't happened. The Bosnian government says it will boycott the talks because of the Serbs' failure to act. Pittsburgh-based USX Corporation is studying its legal options after National Steel hired away the top 6 executives of USX's largest steel mill. Kevin Gavin of member station WDUQ reports.
USX, the nation's largest steelmaker, calls the move an insidious raid. National Steel, which is owned by NKK of Japan, recruited V. John Goodwin as its new president and Robert Greer as chief financial officer. They had been general manager and controller, respectively, at USX's Gary, Indiana Works, the company's most profitable steelmaking facility. Four other top aides to Goodwin bolted USX for National. Analysts say National has not taken advantage of the best conditions in the steel industry in two decades, and that it's been inconsistent in meeting quality demands of the automotive and building industries. What legal action USX can take to stop the raid is uncertain, but there have been cases where courts blocked mass hirings by one company from another. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Gavin in Pittsburgh.
A big healthcare chain is going to pay nearly $4.5 million to Florida residents. Humana Incorporated is paying to settle claims and an overcharge for hospital stays. Humana has agreed to pay nearly $2 million to some 37,000 Florida residents for the costs of their care and the investigation. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Sedaris's essays on Morning Edition have won him a lot of fans, including me. Maybe you remember his diary entry about the Christmas he worked as an elf named Crumpet in Macy's Santa Land, or his essay about why he plots revenge against people who tell him to stop smoking. David Sedaris does his writing at night. By day, he earns a living cleaning apartments in New York. That was also the subject of one of his Morning Edition essays. Now several of his essays and short stories are collected in a new book called Barrel Fever. We invited David Sedaris to read from the book and talk with us about it. This is an excerpt of a short story called Parade.
I'm in this week's People magazine, but not on the cover. Bruce Springsteen is on the cover with what's-her-name, that flat-faced new wife of his, Patty Scholastica or Scoliosis, something like that. In the article, she refers to Bruce as the boss and discusses what she calls his private side. If she's calling Bruce the boss, I can tell you she knows absolutely nothing about his private side. I was the boss when Bruce and I were together. Maybe I should give this Patty person a call and tell her how Bruce needs to have it. Give her a few pointers and clear up this boss issue once and for all. Tell her how Bruce groveled and begged for a commitment and how he behaved when I turned him down. I'd said, what's the use of being a multimillionaire when you walk around dressed like a second-shift welder at U.S. Pipe and Boiler? Bruce wants to keep in touch with his people, which is admirable in theory, but grotesque when you consider the fact that his people consume gasoline, domestic beer, and acne medication in equal amounts. Bruce took it hard and picked up these women on the rebound. I remember running into that last wife of his, the model, at a party. It was she, I, Morley Safer, and Waylon Jennings. We were waiting for the elevator, and she was saying to Waylon that Bruce had just donated seven figures to charity. And I said, no matter how much money Bruce gives to charity, I still say he's one of the tightest men I've ever known. Went right over her head. But Morley knew what I was talking about, and we shared a smile. I am in this week's People magazine celebrating my love with Charlton Heston. There are pictures of me tossing a pillow into his face, pretending to be caught during a playful spat. You know that we can be real with one another because on the next page, there I am, standing on tiptoe, planting a big kiss on his neck while Burgess Meredith, Bobby Packwood, and some other old queens are standing and applauding in the background. Then I'm in the kitchen, flipping pancakes to show I'm capable. I'm walking down the street with Charlton Heston, and then I'm staring out to sea, digging my bare toes deep into the sand in this week's People magazine.
And that's David Sedaris reading a story from his new collection called Barrel Fever. David, what inspired that story?
I had this enormous crush on Mike Tyson and just wondered what it might be like to be like a celebrity and be Mike Tyson's boyfriend. I suppose part of it was talking about a gay relationship the way that everyone on television talks about heterosexual relationships. Like if you turn on any kind of a talk show during the day and they're interviewing a celebrity, they'll talk all about the relationship. And I just thought it would be funny to have a gay character talk about his relationship with the exact same celebrities.
Right, who aren't gay.
Right, but you know how that is. I mean, everyone has a friend who lives in Los Angeles and will tell you that everyone is gay.
Right.
It doesn't matter who the star is. So I just pick stars that you would never, like Morley Safer, you would never really think about his sexuality one way or the other. You don't think of him that way.
It strikes me, David, that you have a very interesting relationship with fame. On the one hand, some of your characters are really obsessed with fame. On the other hand, you've turned down a considerable number of offers for really interesting projects, as if you were trying to avoid fame yourself.
I guess it's just scary being shoved down people's throats.
Is that how you see it, if somebody offers you an interesting opportunity, that they're going to shove you down somebody's throat?
Yeah. Or that's where you come out the other end. Like in People magazine, say, everyone is shown flipping pancakes. If you're going to be in People magazine, they're going to take a picture of you and your partner flipping pancakes. And they're going to take another picture of you wrestling on the sofa with whatever pet it is that you happen to own. And then you come out the other end, I don't know, just kind of... And then it's someone else's chance.
You're on a book tour now. You're at the beginning stages of a book tour. Last night you were in New York, where you live, doing a book signing. So what's that like for you, to have your fans gather around wanting your autograph? Maybe a few people wanted to take their picture with you and everything. How does it feel?
It was everything I ever fantasized it to be. Really, all I ever wanted was a book and a reliable drug dealer. Those are the only two things that I ever asked for out of life. And last night, it was perfect. It was absolutely just exactly the way I had always fantasized it. It was perfect. And I thought this morning, well, if the plane crashes, that's okay, because I haven't really figured out what I want to do next. Like, I just knew I wanted the book, and now I have it. You know how that goes? Like, say if all you want to do is get married, and then you get married, and then you think, oh, I guess I need another goal now.
My guest is David Sedaris. His new book of essays and short stories is called Barrel Fever. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with writer David Sedaris. I want you to read an excerpt of one of the essays that's published in your new book, Barrel Fever. And some of our listeners may remember this from Morning Edition, because you read a different version of this on Morning Edition. But since you clean houses by day for a living, I thought this passage shed some interesting light on the history of orderliness in your family. Would you read the passage for us?
Sure. My mother was never much of a housekeeper, and it drove me to distraction, the chaos of our home. 5 years after moving to Raleigh, we still had Mayflower boxes in the living room. I would return home from school, place my coat and books neatly in my bedroom, activate the vacuum cleaner, and set to work, gathering up my sister's clothing, their half-emptied glasses, the bowls of potato chip crumbs left before the television set, washing dishes, polishing furniture, and thinking that it wasn't fair. I had been switched at birth and carried back to the wrong household. Somewhere my natural family spent their days observing strict laboratory conditions and wondering what had become of me. My own bedroom was immaculate, a shrine. I cleaned it every day. My sisters were not allowed to cross the threshold. They stood in the hallway, observing me as if I were an exotic zoo animal displayed in his natural habitat. When my mother was pregnant with her sixth child, my father finally gave in and allowed her to hire a housekeeper one day a week. When Lena was introduced, I thought we were finally getting somewhere. I left for school as my mother turned on the portable TV and handed her a cup of coffee. I returned from school 7 hours later to find an ironing board in the kitchen, Mom and Lena in roughly the same position, watching TV and drinking coffee. It struck me as the perfect union. The two laziest people on the face of the earth coming together to watch Mike Douglas in General Hospital. I ran to touch the vacuum cleaner and found it stone cold. It wasn't fair.
David, what bothered you about growing up in a disorderly house?
Oh, everything about it. There were six children, and nobody cared but me. Nobody else seemed to care what the house looked like. And if I didn't care either, it would have been fine. But it was my... It was my goal to have that house look clean for 10 straight minutes. That's all I ever wanted. And it was just something that was never going to happen.
You write that your bedroom was like a shrine. What did you keep in your bedroom?
Oh, you know, it was all decorated with posters, and I vacuumed it every day, and I had, you know, the little sculptures that I would buy at the craft fair, and it was... You know, I had my curtains matching my bedspread, and I've been making my own bed since I was able to walk. It was the only made bed in that house. And it was my temple. And nobody else was allowed in the bedroom. I had an alarm put on my door.
Oh, you're kidding.
No.
For your family, if anyone from your family walked in, the alarm would go off?
Because, and I had
you
a
must
small
have been real
bedroom.
Popular.
I had a small bedroom, and I had four sisters. And one brother. And my brother was a baby then, so he had his own bedroom. And I had my own bedroom, but it was smaller than I wanted it to be. So I kept trying to strike deals with my sister to buy their bedroom. They had a big bedroom. And at one point, I bought their bedroom from them for $4. And then my parents caught me moving my things into their huge room. And, yeah, I had a contract and everything.
How'd you arrive at $4 as the fair price?
That was the money that I had, and I convinced them of the magnificent things that they could buy for $4. The whole world would open up to you if you had $4.
One of the stories that you read on NPR's Morning Edition that's also included in your new collection of stories, Barrel Fever, has to do with the time when you auditioned for a magazine called Giantess Magazine. Do you want to describe what the magazine does?
It's a magazine devoted to women, to the notion of women who are anywhere from 10 to 75 feet tall. And it's illustrated with drawings rather than photographs. And it's for men who really, that's what they want, a really big girlfriend. And they sent me some issues, and I studied that magazine. I just couldn't get it. There was something I was missing there. And they had, all the stories had titles like a growing Girl and The Big Date. And they would do something like, you know, they told me it's not important why the woman grows to be 75 feet tall. Just get her there. Which seems like a pretty key plot point to me. But, he told me that the readers... greatest thrill is hearing the clothing tear when the woman outgrows her clothing.
Now, did you try to write a story that would suit this particular obsession?
I did, but I couldn't do it seriously. I just was wound up making fun of it. I just couldn't embrace it seriously because I couldn't understand the desire, A, to have a girlfriend, and B, to have one that's 75 feet tall.
Does it strike you as amusing that one person's sexual fetish is another person's absurdity? One person's sexual excitement is another person's.
And I'm glad. I'm glad it works that way.
What
leaves
you...
a little niche for all of us.
Uh huh. Is that what you walked away thinking after your encounter with Giantess magazine?
Oh yeah, because my sister Amy gave me a magazine once called "Knocked Up and Gun Toting," and it's pregnant women, naked, holding firearms. And, you know, I don't imagine it has a wide circulation, but I imagine that it's, you know, it satisfies its audience completely.
David, I have to ask you about the dust jacket photo on the back of this, your very first book. And there's a picture of you standing in front of a picture of a kitchen, as if you were standing in front of a real kitchen, but it's just a picture of a kitchen with a sink and refrigerator and a nice little window over the sink. And you're holding what appears to be a real cabbage in your hands. What is the meaning of this photograph?
Well, My boyfriend Hugh painted that backdrop, and it was a kitchen scene from the last play that we did.
Mm-hmm.
And then the photographer thought that a cabbage would look good in the color photograph. She thought a cabbage would look good with the backdrop. So, but she was really good. This woman, Karen Kuhn, took the photograph. But you know, I've since the book has come out, I've had to have my picture taken so many times, and the photographer will come to the house and they'll say, "Can you maybe close those louvered doors on your head? Okay, now, could you put on the cat mask and hug your cat? Okay, now, could you maybe hang off those antlers you've got on the wall?" And the art director will come and say, "We've got a few shots left. What do you say we try something silly?" And Karen was the only one who let me be photographed standing up. You know, I'd go for the photo shoot, and they'd have the bucket of soapy water ready for me.
Right.
And thank God I still don't have an elf costume.
Oh, an elf costume?
Like, I would want to be photographed for a magazine in an elf costume. I don't think so. But I don't know where they get the idea that, you know, if you're in a silly situation, something is going to shine through about your personality. It's like I don't know where they got these ideas, but Karen wasn't like that, you know, who did the jacket photograph. She's really great.
I have one last question for you. What were your childhood fantasies and ambitions when you looked ahead and you saw adulthood? What were you hoping for?
In my high school yearbook, I wrote that my ambition was to move to New York City and be famous. That was all I wrote. I didn't know doing what. That I just knew that was... I just always saw myself... all I ever wanted to do was live in New York. And you know, and then I went through different phases, you know, different ages, you know. At one point I was going to live in New York and be the greatest potter that city had ever known. But I just knew I wanted to be in New York. My dad took me there when I was like in the third grade, and I just knew that's where I wanted to be.
David Sedaris, he has a new collection of essays and short stories called Barrel Fever. This is Fresh Air. President Clinton is in Italy. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, will you be following the president on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson is in Italy following the president, Terry, and we will have a report on his meeting with the new head of government there, as well as his meeting with the Pope and his efforts to burnish his image on this tour of Europe. Also, a story on Israel, which has attacked outposts of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. Martha Raddatz will be going to the War College, where they study war and teach military strategy. She'll have a report on that. In Virginia, they're having a little war in the Republican Party over whether or not to nominate Ollie North to run for the Senate.
Thanks, Linda. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The record label EMI Classics has issued a 2-disc set of historic performances of works by Benjamin Britten. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz says these are among the most interesting and important recordings of 20th century music, but there's one selection he's especially excited about.
One of my rarest records is an old 10-inch 78 of an Irish folk song called The Sally Gardens. The composer Benjamin Britten accompanies the extraordinary tenor Peter Pears, who is both his professional and personal partner, in Britten's own arrangement of the song. The actual words are an early poem by Yeats, Down by the Sally Gardens, which was his attempt, as he said, to reconstruct an old song from 3 lines imperfectly remembered by an old peasant woman who often sings them to herself. Britten made many elegant, harmonically surprising arrangements of traditional English and Irish folk songs. In a way, he did the same thing to Yeats's poem that Yeats did to the old woman's imperfectly remembered words. As far as I know, that 1944 recording was never reissued. but now it's just appeared on a new two-disc set that includes all of Britain's early folk song recordings. Now you don't have to come to my house to hear it.
Down by the sally.
I love this song, but two other items on this set are probably of larger significance. They are reissues of the first original cast recordings of extended excerpts from Britain's first two operas, Peter Grimes and The Rape of Lucretia, under the direction of the late British conductor Reginald Goodall. In this excerpt, issued on this CD for the first time, pairs as the rough outcast fisherman Peter Grimes reveals his doomed poetic image of a better life.
I've seen in stars the light that we might share. Seen in stars the light we share. Fruit in the garden, children by the shore.
Both Peter Grimes and The Rape of Lucretia are available in magnificent, complete performances conducted by the composer. But these early recordings are special in their own way. The voice of Peter Pears later grew darker and more strained. Here you can hear both the strangeness and youthfulness that inspired Britten to write so many great roles for him.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and a recent recipient of a Pulitzer Prize. He reviewed a new album of historic Benjamin Britten recordings on EMI Classics. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Big Bands, we feature interviews with Artie Shaw and the late Woody Herman. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.